You don't dislike people simply because they phoned you too much. I've listened to the first half hour of that program, and it was appalling. Given a choice between Brian Hayes and Terry Wogan, I would have Terry Wogan on my radio station.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Brian Hayes.
I was born in Western Australia, in Perth, but I was only born there because I was then taken to the goldfields, Kalgoorlie. It was a dirty, dusty place, very, very hot. Then it got to the stage where school was being a bit of a bind, really. I didn't get on with the maths and all of that kind of stuff. So I decided that I wasn't going to continue. Kind of escaped and went to live with my grandparents. I should say that my mother was in a town a little way away. I still can't understand why they took it so calmly. I just turned up on the door and said, I'm here to stay. Anyway, so I started there and I went to do a kind of course at a technical college. I wanted to learn to type. I wanted to do more in English. My first job was at the newspaper, the Kalgoorlie Miner, it was called. But I was very fascinated by what newspapers did. In a small place like that, it was a real newspaper, you know. So I looked at where they printed the paper and all of that kind of stuff, and I started to get a bit of a bug. I started to think of the possibilities in that area. And then I had an offer of a job, believe it or not. I was 15, but had the offer of a job to work for twice the money at the Chamber of Mines. Then I got another job at a mining company. The most important thing I did was in the morning, I'd get the mail to take around to all the different parts of the mine and deliver mail. And I would be singing songs by myself on the way. The one I can remember was, do you remember Joe Stafford's You Belong to Me? That was the one I remembered and that was the one I sang.
See the pyramids along the Nile.
So I settled in there. Quite enjoyed it. Then I went on a brief holiday to, they were my mother's family, and they were in Perth, so I had to go to Perth, and I stayed there for a little while. You know, Perth was a big city to us, you know, it is now, but it was only about the size of Edinburgh as it was some little time back. When I went back to work, somebody said, I've just heard that they have been advertising at the local radio station for an announcer, as they were called. I said, oh, well, yeah, what do I do? Where? And they said, well, phone them. So I phoned them straight away. See, I can't believe this, even when I tell it. They said, would you come in for an audition? And I had a squeaky little voice, I don't doubt. And I went in. They didn't broadcast all day. So they were off in the afternoon and came on again at 5 o'clock. And that was the children's show. And they were about to set up for the children's show, and they told them, stop, we're going to do an audition. Before we do that, we had one studio, one tape recorder, an old-fashioned, ordinary tape recorder. And so I read a couple of pieces of paper, and as I was going out, the manager said, when can you start? Now, the thing is, I was always interested in radio in the sense that I listened to it, but in a very, very serious way. I listened to The Goon Show, and I listened to Take It From Here. That's the kind of thing. And I had to tell everybody else in the where I was living, that be quiet because I'm listening to this.
Take it from here. Don't go away when you can take it from here.
And I listened to the local station's chart show, as we would now call it. It was The Hit Parade. And so I knew that fairly well. And then I heard a lot of other stuff that I didn't think was very good. Decided to go there, except that my grandfather did not approve because it was like, you know, other transients, you know, people who go from job to job. It wasn't a very secure kind of thing. And so he said, I disapprove of this and I am not going to let you do it. I said, I'll ask my mum. So I sent her a telegram, something along the lines of request permission to take a job at a radio station. And she answered back and she said, of course you can, darling. And I told my grandfather, and he was furious. So it started. I started doing the job. And my grandfather eventually came around when he heard me, and he heard me reading a news bulletin. And it was all right then. So that was my first radio job, and I was there for about 4 years. The manager there was a guy called Lloyd Lawson. He was well known a little bit later across Australia, quite handsome and charismatic. He encouraged me a lot. And when we had meetings, and he'd tear a strip off most of them, and he'd say, "And Brian, you've done very well." And so I thought, "Thank you, sir." His name was Lloyd Lawson. He stayed in the business there for many, many years and became nationally known for some commercials he was doing. And his wife, I should mention, was also in the business. She had a lovely voice and was very good doing women's programs. So after a while, the management changed, and a man came in called Bill Atwell. Now, he was a very diffident kind of chap. He didn't have much confidence in himself or in anybody else. But I got on well with him, because you make sure you do, don't you? And he said, "I'm going to be moving to another radio station, which is in Bunbury in the same state. The station's not been built or anything yet, but the head of that network has asked me to set it up." The studio and the office were actually tacked on to the back of an electrical store. I remember that where you made the coffee was right next to the toilet. Well, in a way, these two stations merged in what I was doing, because I just knew it could all be done much better. I was hearing people who were dull to listen to, and I didn't think that you should be dull. I heard them playing music that didn't match anything, so I started selecting the music. And they had a reasonable library. They were all 78s, of course. Anyway, we made an effort to improve things. Many of the other people didn't like it very much, but some young enthusiasts got the drift, you know, and I was then offered this other job to go to this other station, and that was where I continued my crusade, so to speak. But we had better people there too, and we became a fairly popular local station, which had a bit of the usual things, you know, some news, there was sport, there was local cricket coverage, things like that. I got to invent programs and present them. I was doing the nighttime program because television hadn't been invented where we lived. And I can remember playing one night a piece by Leonard Bernstein, and it was a little bit kind of iffy in the sense that it was not very melodic. And the manager at that time, who didn't have the sense of anything to discuss music, he just didn't like it. So he rang me while I was on the air, which you should never do. He said, "Take that music off." And I said, "No, I'm not taking it off. Why would I do that?" He said, "Because it's not very good and I don't like it, and I want you to take it off." I said, "Well, if you want to take it off, you'll have to come to the studio and do it, because I'm not taking it off." Now, I don't know where I got that kind of gumption from, but I just thought that that was wrong. You don't do that. And he didn't do anything. He came the next day. And we became not exactly friends, but we could get on. And he made me the assistant to him running the station. And so that all happened, except a new boss came. We're up to about 65. This new manager came in, and he was just a salesman. That's all he was. And he didn't like me at all. So he said, "You'll have to go. You're sacked." By then, I had a wife and child. A baby. Not just a child, baby. And I thought, this is humiliating, apart from anything else. He said, "You've got to leave today." I said, "That's a little bit urgent, isn't it?" And he said, "Yes, and take anything from the office," because I had my own office, that is yours. Afterwards, there was a row about a dictionary, one of these big dictionaries, and he claimed that belonged to the station. I said, no, that was mine. And he said, "Well, I'm going to take it to the police or something." So I don't know how I did this, but I got in touch with a lawyer and said, "What do you think I should do?" He said, "I'll send a letter. saying that it is yours. And he got the letter, and that was the end of that. But then I had to get this next job, and there was nowhere else in that town. So Perth was the next place. You know, in Australia, Western Australia, they have bushfires. And so I was driving up from Bunbury to Perth, it's about 110 miles, almost every day through the bushfires, in the sense that they were burning either side of the road. But it could have been very dangerous. But I had no choice, because a wife and child were back in Bunbury keeping the ship afloat. And I went to each of the radio stations in Perth. There were two ABC and four commercial. The ABC, I didn't think I would fit in there. That was not quite what I wanted to do. It was very up itself, if you'll pardon the expression. And I went to four of them, and one of them, a wonderful man called Stan Jervis, talked to me for a while, and he said, very carelessly, I thought, he said, well, see that guy just over there? I'm sacking him. You can do his job, which is presenting mostly. And also, you can help the producer of the talk format in the morning. So the other bloke, got sacked. And I started working there. And I, after a little while, I got my hands on more things. And I became the assistant of the producer, as I said. And it was this wonderful woman called Leslie Anderson. She was a journalist, a columnist on the local Sunday Times. It was a Sunday Times, which was even then related to Rupert Murdoch. And she had been a reporter in Vietnam. She had done everything you would expect of somebody like that, and she was brilliant on the air. She had a not very good voice, she had a lisp, and she was a bit gruff, but she smoked a cigar, and she was just so impressive. And we worked together. I would help her get through the program. I didn't do much of the content, very little in fact, but helped her. We'd get guests and all that kind of thing. I learned more from her, I think, in a couple of weeks than I've learned from anybody since. She died not very long ago. She was very interested in the state's history and all of that kind of thing. She was a terrific woman. And I nursed the students from the university when they were doing a student's program, which we chose to broadcast. And a couple of those I'm still friends with. And then one night, my wife and I were sitting at the table after having eaten. She was working at that stage what they called the National Theatre. It wasn't a National Theatre, it was a state theatre. She was doing the publicity. We both sort of, for some bizarre reason, came to the same conclusion. What are we going to do now? What's next? Is this all there is? In the words of Peggy Lee. So we started thinking, and we eventually came up with the idea of going to London if we could, but on the way, stopping over at Rome for a couple of months, which we subsequently did. And then we arrived at Victoria Station, and we thought, now what? What do you do now? We've got to find somewhere to live. So we found a little booth on the corner. Today I wouldn't go near a place like that. And anyway, they said they could give us rent us a flat in Earl's Court. Earl's Court was not as bad as I expected it to be. I thought there'd be awful other Australians everywhere. We settled there for a couple of days, but we very quickly realised we couldn't stay there. It wasn't very convenient for anything. We managed to rent a flat in Finsbury Park. And that was in a time when the colour of the population was changing, had changed to a large degree. And we were in this world where there was reggae music playing all the time and a really mixed kind of community. Well, that was something new for us for a start. So we got a bit used to that. Then, because I was looking for work and I couldn't get anything that I wanted, I ended up at one stage I was working, and this was for about a year, as I could tell everybody, an usherette, showing people to their seats, tearing tickets. And I saw a lot of good movies there. And that was at the Dominion. The Dominion, and over the road was the Astoria, which was no longer in existence. And I got a job at the Press Association. It was a copy taker. I thought, that was the typing that I learned. If you could type fast, then you could do the job, which was taking news over the phone. There was a row, there were about 30 of us, And we all had these key lamp systems. You take your turn in answering, and certain times of the day, we were all answering at the same time. And I quite liked that. Then when the radio stations started to be talked about, because we knew when we left Australia, it had been reported in the Times version of the paper there that the government had granted permission for radio stations to be established in London and then other parts of the country. Huey Green was involved in those days in applying for it, and I remember he had his place was above Baker Street Station, and I remember going there only to be told that he's not interested in anybody that has your kind of ability, blah, blah.
We have put all these dots on here which represent the 115 medium frequency, which everybody can hear, medium frequency, low-powered local stations, which will be able to be heard both by day and by night.
Anyway, fast forward a bit, I found that Capital had an office at Piccadilly, so I rang them and they said, yes, come in. So I did, and they were just such a fantastic group of people. And Michael Bucht was the one who interviewed me. I had sent him a letter, and in the letter I made reference to what I'd been doing, and he was quite impressed by that. And he said, well, I've got something that you could do, which is probably very, very much the same, and that was helping out doing phone-in shows. With people that had not really done them before, but it was one of the things in the format. You know, Marcia Hunt was one of my presenters. She was one of the most difficult people in the world to work with, but she was very nice. And so I worked for her and Alan Hargreaves, who was from Thames, and he was all very smarmy, he was good at getting people to apply for services. Well, if you want that, you have to go to so-and-so. And if you want that, so-and-so.
The number, remember, 388-1255. My thanks to my guests, John Trevelyan and Michael Bucht. My thanks to lovely Sue, who did the research. And don't forget, the lines open, the time, 8:30, tomorrow night.
Never indulge in anything that was described as discussion or anything like that. They didn't do that, really. And I produced the Sunday morning religious program for my sins. The presenter of that was hilarious. But he was very mouldable. I mean, I worked on him. I said, why don't we do all of the religions in order, have one every week? And we got to the Buddhist, and he said, how are we going to do this? I said, well, one thing you should know, you probably do know, but I'm just going to tell you, Buddhists will not answer a question straight away. They wait, think about it, and then say it. So, when this happens, don't jump in, because you'll ruin the whole thing. The program won't survive. So he did it, you know. And when the first kind of silence came up, and you could see the presenter, he couldn't quite believe, you know, that I was letting him just sit there. Then he got into the rhythm, and it turned out to be fascinating because we were all then listening to exactly what they were saying. So I thought that was a good, you know, a sum up. Isn't it good to know? Capital Radio was a very glamorous organisation. It was a big city radio station, even though they didn't quite know what they were doing. But they did have the support. They had some space in a tall, shiny building on the corner of the top of Tottenham Court Road. They had a huge staircase, which fascinated everybody. And they had a lot of star names, people who had been in the business, not the radio business as such, but they'd been doing a bit of television, or they'd done other things, a theatre. And a lot of disc jockeys who had worked on biscuit factory, which I knew nothing about. And over the years, I've come to know lots of them. They seem to manufacture them along with the biscuits. So you had this mixture, and then a few odd people like me. There was a woman who worked on the desk that I worked on. I can't remember her name now quite, but she was employed, I think, by Michael Bucht, and I think she was Swiss. And she had a completely different view of the world from the rest of us. And she would just ring up and book someone without telling anybody anything, book a guest for the Marsha Hunt programme. And I'd say, but do you know anything about that person? She said, no. And I said, well, but I would like you to investigate a bit, because I wouldn't book her for the world, you know. And she said, oh, all right, you do it. No, I said, that's not the point. Yeah, the point is you've got to learn how to book guests. And that was one of the things that kept coming up over the years. She wasn't there all that long. And at the next desk, there was a bloke called Tim Rice, who was doing a Saturday music programme. And I got to know him quite well, to the point where I went to, you know, opening nights of Chess and things like that. And I haven't seen him for a long time, but that's what happens in this kind of whirly-gither world.
We should think of something really weird like that to photograph. We haven't photographed anything really weird except the hi-fi.
Well, we photographed Monty Python when he came in yesterday, and we
that's
still
weird.
Got...
That's weird!
That's weird! We still have one photograph left of Monty Python, so if you'd like to phone in now, 3881255, then you'll...
You know, there's Dave Cash, and there was Kenny Everett, who I used to have a drink with at the local pub after I did my phone-in on a Tuesday night. He had to come in every Tuesday to talk to Buck about his programme. And so we would go over there, and he had a Corella. You know, they're a big parrot. And he had one of those, and it would sit on his shoulder. And he'd come into Capital on a Tuesday afternoon, and his Corella would be with him. And his Corella would be with him when he was lying on the floor in my studio with headphones on, listening to my programme as it went out. And then we'd go out to the pub, and the Corella would go to the pub with us. And Kenny used to carry, was it rum? I don't know. No, I think it was more like vodka, a flask in his hip pocket. And I said, what would you like? And he said, no, I've got mine. And so I bought a beer, and so we would chat away. And then he was a bit of a will-o'-the-wisp, and he'd suddenly say, well, I'm going now. Off, and he's gone. And that happened lots of times, but it was just the way he was. He was one of the most lovely people I've ever known. I mean, most people would say exactly the same thing. It's nothing, no great revelation.
Welcome. They said it couldn't be done. And it can't. So instead, here's the Hot 100 show.
So they were the kind of people that were working there, and it was a bustling place, and they were doing things badly for a while, but they seemed to learn, he said patronisingly, very quickly. You know, they bought this very expensive system which would automatically load the cassettes and so on, which would have your commercials and ad breaks and so on. But it failed, and they had to start doing it by hand. I loved every minute of working there.
Alan Hargreaves here, and that's Open Line for tonight. It's closing down, but...
I had to take over when... Alan Hargreaves left the 7:30, I think it was, phone-in, and I'd been producing it, and Michael Buck and I had to sit around and work out who we were going to get to do it. And we came up with a couple of names, and we couldn't get anybody that we wanted. And I said to him, you know, we're in this awful position that the people we want don't want us, and the people who we don't want do want to work for us. Yeah, so we looked at the market, but not surprisingly, really, where would people come from with that kind of experience? So I went, at the request of Ron Onions, who I knew at Capital, to see him at LBC, where he had become the IRN news editor.
And it was indicated to me that... an approach would be made to me to come to this station. No, I said, not that.
And I liked him, and he's another person who I admired a great deal and liked a great deal right through until when he died. And he just said, come around and have a look around, you know. And he wasn't mentioning a job or anything like that, but when we started walking around, when he did this and saw that and all that, and I was thinking, dear me, I don't like the look of this place, because it started out in quite a mess. It was mainly because they didn't know how to set up a radio station. They had far too many people, far too many without any experience, and they were all wandering around wondering what they were supposed to be doing. I exaggerate slightly, and that was mainly at the time before I started there. Adrian Love had been working elsewhere, indeed at LBC, and they said that he wanted to have my job. And I said, but that would just seem like, you know, a kind of a neat swap for the stations. And anyway, that came to pass. And so I started at LBC and he started at Capital, and we were quite friends. And he had a completely different style, which is probably why I didn't rate him as much, which is childish, I suppose, in a way.
LBC, 97.3 stereo, where news comes first.
Right on, right on, right on. 8 minutes past 11, Nightline. We are going to open the lines, because talking to Tom about kids, I suddenly
there was a woman at Capital Radio who we called the head of everything. When you wanted a holiday, when you all of that kind of, you know, administration stuff, and she was brilliant. She had done this job at Thames Television apparently for quite a while, and I always got on terribly well for her. And she organised things to do with passports and all of that. And I came back after having seen Ron Onions and accepted his offer, and I thought, now I've got to play this very carefully, because I've got 3 months, but my contract is ending now. What am I going to do? And I said to her that I'd like to renew the contract, but only for 3 months. Now, I would have seen through that, but she either didn't or didn't care. And she just said, oh, that's all right. And I said, and then I'm going to LBC. Oh, you devil, you know. I said, I'm sorry, but I had to do it like that. She could have, of course, just wiped the floor with me, but she didn't. By the time I'd arrived there, a man called Marshall Stewart had come from the BBC. He'd been the editor of the Today programme. He was very good. He was solid, wasn't a laugh, but he was very solid and very interesting, and obviously with the experience he had, he was very good to listen to, because he knew how to do it. So he picked programmes bit by bit. And George Gale, who was a well-known newspaper columnist, a very, very good one, who they'd had doing the morning phone-in show, he'd reached his sell-by date, let's put it that way, and they were all trying to work out how, having used him like that, how do we now get him moved somewhere else?
I still don't quite see the purpose of this one. If they banned traffic altogether around St. Paul's, there might be something to be said for it if they were to make it a kind of pedestrian precinct. But since you've also got vans and so on using it for delivery purposes and so forth, it just seems to me to have made a lot of complication needlessly.
Thing about that was the other day
they offered him obviously some incentive to leave, but we still wanted to do it, and so they put a slot in the afternoon, and he did that for a while. In the meantime, they asked me if I would do the mid-morning phone-in, and that was just exactly what I was waiting for all these years. That's what I wanted. And the first morning, Margaret Thatcher was the first guest, and it kind of took off. Margaret Thatcher was, well, she was a hate figure. It still is a hate figure. Not everybody, obviously. That would be stupid. She wouldn't have been elected as the Prime Minister otherwise. But she was not friendly. And when she came in, we told her she had to wear headphones. Well, you would have thought that the world had blown up, you know. And I explained to her why. I can actually be terribly patient and warm when I need to be, and I needed to be. So she put them on, and that prompted a front-page newspaper picture of her with headphones on for the first time. And in the break for the 11 o'clock news, we slid out of the studio and stood in the corridor, and I said, how do you feel about it? And she said, I don't like the headphones and all of that. And I could see that she was really very flushed at the neck. And I thought, oh, poor thing, she's very nervous. And she was very nervous. So we snuck back in, and she just got a little bit of oomph out of that, because I was going there, you know, everything's going fine and you're doing a good job. And so we finished the programme, and she disappeared off, whooshed, she was gone. And it was a good thing for your first programme. It was a good thing to have. And we followed it with leading trade union leader, whose name escapes me, because there was a steel, we don't have these things now, but a steel strike, quite big one. And we had the boss of the union. And that was good and solid too on the first day. So we thought, up and running, and off we go. Now, it wasn't always like that. It was sometimes very, very hard work indeed, because what you don't want is to end up with a three-hour programme with me banging on to people who were banging on back to me, because that's not very interesting. It doesn't really work. Because, you know, it was early days, and everybody was really very kind of nervous and didn't have any confidence themselves. You say, would you come in to do the programme? They said, what do you mean by do the programme? So we explained and said, well, I'll interview you and you can answer the questions and so on. You know, they said, but this will be live on the radio. I said, yes, it will, and there'll be people calling in. And it was very difficult to get a lot of people to quite understand what it was that made it work. Now, why should they? You know, it's not something that you learn at school or anything like that. And let's face it, I didn't know all that much in the early days. Gradually, we settled in. It was a few years, actually, before I thought we'd actually just about got there. And I think this was 1976, because I started there at the beginning of that year. What surprised a lot of people was the approach I had was not call me and we'll talk about blah, blah, blah. It was call me and convince me that so-and-so, that you know, it is right for the government to do this. And what they couldn't quite grasp was that I would then argue with them. And people said, why are you challenging me? I said, well, we're never going to get anywhere unless we actually really address this business. You say that, I say this. Now, which one of us is going to give in a bit and affect the thinking of the other? And I really did believe that. I just thought, there is no point in people ringing me and me saying, excellent, I like the way you do this, and then they take the next call. I mean, for goodness sake. And yet people were doing this on stations all over the place. They thought that it was perfectly acceptable to just sort of say nice things to each other or do what they do in America. They all ring up, and if the guy running the program thinks that the Democrats are a gift from God or something, they think it, and so does the person running the program. And what is the use of that? Surely it's much more interesting if you worry a subject, you know, not just kind of say, oh, yes, yes, I agree. But I don't know whether people really grasped that for a while. They still would be surprised and indeed shocked that I would be fairly forcefully arguing something. Not always, because it wasn't always necessary. Some callers, you know, they knew, they instinctively knew where I would be going with something. And there was a woman who had apparently worked for a government department and had a very posh voice, and she would come on and she put a view. Her view was a Tory view, and so we'd argue that out. And then there was a bloke who was a cabinet maker, I think, and he used to call from Chelsea and during his morning work, and he'd give me a kind of laid-back, cool, time-out kind of view of the political scene. And I got to quite like him, because he would disagree with me. Well, obviously, because otherwise there'd be, as I say, no programme. But he did sound like a hippie, I must say. Every now and again, he'd just phone in and lighten up our lives. You know, there were all kinds of people like this.
Inga, good morning.
Good morning, Brian. First of all, congratulations on a wonderful station.
And there were others whose names and suburbs, areas, would go down in history. You know, they were just annoying, but if they phoned, then it's okay. You know, you can't dislike people simply because they phoned you too much.
Well, I'll repeat it just for people who perhaps were not listening on that one day, and I want essays on why not. Somebody phoned in to talk. We were talking about euphemisms with Betty Kirkpatrick of Chambers Dictionaries, and this chap phoned in with a slightly posh voice talking about my actress girlfriend and I. Were going to the theatre or something, and she stepped out of the taxi and said, oh, shit, I've stepped in number two.
There were times when people in the outside world, you know, in government, in the law, even in sporting clubs, these people thought that they had additional clout because of who they were and where they came from. But they also sometimes objected to the line of thinking that we were putting forward, and they thought that was unfair. And I said, well, if you think it's unfair, then what you do is you phone and tell me it's unfair, and we worry it to conclusion. That wasn't good enough for them, and then we did get lawyers who would try it on. An MP said something I'd said, and I wish I could remember it because I could make their story more interesting, but he said that I had libelled him, and I said, well, no, and he got in touch with the management of the station, who called me up to the office, and I listened to what he said, and I said, well, no, I didn't libel him. Here's exactly what I did say, and if we like, we can go back and listen to the recording. And the person involved still wouldn't accept that we hadn't libeled him. In other words, he just felt hurt, really hurt, and he just didn't think anybody should be able to say that in a public medium. Now, I have sympathy with that, of course, but the law is the law. If you're going to use the law, well, then use it. But it doesn't always go in your favour. And there were the kind of calls that you get were so emotional. A lot of people who presented such programmes will tell you they've had somebody who's come on the phone late at night and were talking about taking their life. Or, I was a drunk, or I am a drunk, and all of that. And you have to find a way of getting around that, because calls like that are notoriously difficult to end. You can do whatever you think is the right thing in answering them, but they don't want to go because they're so insecure that they probably would do harm to themselves. So it's up to the people outside the studio to decide whether they should call the police or a social service department or something like that to try and help this person. There was one who I had to deal with a bit, really off the air a couple of times. He was bipolar. As you know, it's way up and way down. And all I had to do was listen, because anybody will probably tell you that. I had a friend who was in a similar situation. But he would phone me. Oh, he phoned me one morning as I was getting ready to leave from home at about 6 a.m. And I had to say, look, I'm going. I've got to go. The car is here to take me to work. And I thought, what am I going to do now? Because I can't do anything at this moment. I got him to promise to call me later that day. And I thought that this is a dicey kind of thing, because he may just take umbrage at that. And so later that day, when I expected him to call, he did. And we talked, and then I got to know him a little bit, which is not what I intended, but sometimes it happens. And it turns out he was a photographer and had been somebody in the business, in the show business in London and elsewhere. He wanted to come in and take photographs of me doing the programme, which he did. And I've got the photographs, and they were excellent. And he told me he'd photographed, Paul Simon and people like that in the late 60s. And then another part of the same story is I lived in Richmond at the time, and he lived in Richmond as well, which kind of made it a bit neat. He rang me another time and said that he's just got some kittens. He knew I liked cats. And there were two very beautiful little black cats. And I, with my son was with me, and I said, what do you think? And he said, let's take them both. And I said, I don't think so. I think that we're probably best to concentrate on the one, which we did. And the cat was lovely, you know, mostly they are. And so that, I think, was the last of the contact I had with him. Well, I don't think I would have been able to sustain it for terribly long, I must say. It's difficult if you're not trained in that. And that's why I worry when I do hear some people giving advice, actual advice to people, which I always shied away from on the radio. And I thought, don't do that. But sometimes they're okay. I mean, you know, Adrian Love, for instance, who we mentioned, he was actually quite good at that. But then he had difficulties himself, and I think that's kind of where it came from, as far as he was concerned. But it is something, it's a challenge that lots of presenters have had to face.
It's coming up to 6:09. As you've been hearing, Gerry Adams invited one of his most bitter opponents to shake hands when he confronted Unionist MP Ken McGuinness.
The people I interviewed over the years were extraordinary. You know, there was a novelist, you know, the Durrell family, you know, they were all writers. Lawrence Durrell was one of the great writers. He didn't give interviews, but he had a novel coming out, and they asked me whether I'd like to do it, and they said he is extremely difficult, and everything they told me was negative. And I said I'd still like to do it. It has to be next week, because I need to read up on some books. They got me all of the... This is before we had computer and the internet and everything. And they got me all of the newspaper clippings I could get from the Press Association, all kinds of publicity and everything. And I took it home for a weekend and I soaked myself in Lawrence Durrell. Beautiful, beautiful writer. The new book was called Quincunks. You know, he had weird titles. And I said to him, what does that actually mean? And he said, it's very difficult to explain. And he tried, and he tried harder. Then I said, is it? And I just spilled out what I thought I understood it to be, given what he'd written about it in the book. And he said, yeah, that's right. He said, you know it better than I do. And he relaxed and I relaxed, and we then had a very nice discussion about, you know, writing and all of that. That was one of the great things. I was able to interview so many extraordinary people, you know. In the day when, you know, Dustin Hoffman came in, people at the station were all gathering, looking through the glass. And when Michael Crawford came in, that was one of the biggest days we had. But we had amazing people, including politicians, and all of that is, you know, it just goes past you, and you keep thinking about, yes, but what did I do?
If it's worth thinking about, it's worth talking about. Call Brian Hayes now, 353-8111.
When I left LBC, it's not really the way I would have put it. It is, in fact, what I did, but... The radio station, LBC, had been taken over by people I did not respect. The boss at the time said, we want to put you onto the 7 o'clock at night slot, another shift. I said, I don't do a shift, I do a program, which is unnecessary. And he said, well, it's going to happen, you know. And I said, and who's going to do the shift in the morning? And that's when I think Michael Parkinson came in. Now, I knew him, and he had done things before. He was a big name. That's why he wanted him. I said, OK, then, I'm going on holiday tonight. And he said, OK. I said, so that means I won't be coming back here again, ever. And he said, oh, OK. He said, by the time I've finished with this station, you won't recognise it at all. And as I said in a newspaper piece I wrote once, he was right. We didn't recognise it after a short time. And I went off looking around for things. The first thing that happened was that I had a call from Matthew Bannister at GLR, as it was then called, offering me to start work on Monday. And I said, no, I've been doing one thing for 15 years, and I really do have to sort my head out. And the radio festival happened to be on that weekend. I think it was Glasgow. So I went to that, and a lot of people came, said, what are you going to do? And other people said, come and work for us. Notably, the BBC did. And I said, well, I don't want to talk about it or think about it yet. When we all get back to work in London and all of that, let's arrange to meet. And we did. And Jenny Abramski and two other, they were all women at the time, and all very impressive. And I had known Jenny Abramski before. They took me around the corner from a broadcasting house for lunch, and we talked, and one of them just said to me, what do you actually want to do? And I said, that's my problem. I don't know. I haven't the faintest idea what I would want to do, particularly with the BBC, because it's not in my blood, really. And they said, yeah, well, we understand that. And I said, I really have to give myself, you know, a matter of months before. And I said, I can't look at your schedule and see anything that I would feel comfortable in. So what happened later was I kept getting little offers of programs, many of which I subsequently did. You know, the half-hour quiz program and things like that. And I'd never done that kind of thing before, and I got to quite like it, because it was a challenge in a way, but not so much that it affected the value of your work.
We're with you night and day, across the UK, it's Radio 2.
Frances Lyne called me. I was doing something else on Radio 2 at the time. She called me and said, would you see me in the office? And I said, yeah, sure. Yeah, and I got on well with her. I always made it my business to get on well with them. But they were mostly nice people. After a bit of small talk, she said, we'd like to offer you the breakfast show. I said, really? Why would you want to do that? And she talked about you could bring the serious side as well as a light side to the programme, etc., etc. And I must admit, I was flattered, but also a bit kind of wary. And I had to think about that quite a lot. But eventually I thought, well, it's no doubt going to pay well, and it'll be hard work, both of which I'm happy about. So I agreed, and that was 3 months hence. Because when it's Radio 2, it's big, big deal, you know, and you get Woman's Magazine ringing you up to take photographs, you know, and they'd have a whole team of photographers and all that. And I thought, God, what is going on? But I should have known better, because it's the way things were and are. And so I went through all that. I had to learn a lot of things about how you present yourself. And then I got to talk to the producer, who was somebody I'd met. They didn't have any ideas for it, except that it would just have a little bit more kind of newsy chat, you know, that's about all. And I thought that was a mistake. Anyway, so we got going. I've listened to the first half hour of that programme, and it was appalling. It was really awful. The response to it was not all that good. So we actually put on the programme a full-time researcher, and we discussed all of the things we could do. And after about 3 or 4 months, it was starting to come together.
Yes, good morning, UK. This is it, the Great British Breakfast Show.
We were getting guests in. I'd say, you know, we're having so-and-so for breakfast, which was supposed to be a double-edged kind of remark. And it was amazing how many people were quite happy to come in at 7:30 in the morning. We would just chat to them. They could talk for about 2 minutes or something, and we'd play music. And it worked quite well. And then I got this idea that I was going to take the photograph of every one of them. So each time when they were talking, whoever they were, I would take their photographs, and I've got them at home. Then we started getting response from the audience. I also added, you know, what's happened in Coronation Street. I used to do that at 8:30, and EastEnders. And I used to watch them then. People liked that. And then I had communication from Coronation Street, saying, you know, we're sending you a card and everything, and if you want to come and join us for blah, 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 all of that kind of thing. I thought, oh, this is obviously got some traction. And so we kept doing that, but it wasn't fast enough. It wasn't big enough, and I wasn't Terry Wogan. That's the trouble. If I had been Terry Wogan, I would probably still be there. Terry, as you know, had done his talk show on television. People used to say it didn't go very well. Well, I thought it was perfectly all right. May have been at the wrong time, or there could have been all kinds of other reasons. But anyway, he decided to go, and so did the bosses. Then he managed to persuade whoever the boss was of Light Entertainment that he could go back to the breakfast show. And so I was called up to the office again and told that Terry Wogan wants his programme back. And I said, well, what are you going to do? He said, it's a choice. And Frances Lyne said, yes, I know, and it's a very difficult one. If Terry Wogan wants to come back, then I'm afraid we're going to take him. And I said, well, look, Frances, if I were you, I would do exactly the same thing. Given a choice between Brian Hayes and Terry Wogan, I would have Terry Wogan on my radio station. Although I was a bit hurt, not terribly. You know, you can't be hurt by these things. It was a year I did, exactly a year. So I was glad I did it. It's the luck of the draw, isn't it? You can't get yourself in a state about such things. I walked away, and Terry Wogan walked back. He was very charming and very friendly and all of that kind of thing.
I must be brutally frank with you. I'm looking different than when I left you 8 and a bit years ago. Slimmer? Yes. More distinguished? Yes. But also wearing the bins. I cannot see me hand in front of me face these days.
Hello, I'm Brian Hayes. Next weekend, I'll be on Radio 2 with a new series. We'll be discussing the issues, great and small.
I had continued to do a phone-in on GLR, and I had a call from Radio 2. They said that we can pay you what you're getting for the GLR programme. We can pay you that same amount for doing one night a week, doing a phone-in for Radio 2. I thought for a while, and I thought, yeah, well, that's all right. Yes, that would be fine. So I did that, and it actually took off quite well. And we had quite good figures. It was when Jim Moyer came along, and he was making all kinds of changes, and that was perfectly reasonable. Why shouldn't he? But one of them meant that eventually my program was going to end. But he said, I'll give you something else, which he did, and that was, so I was doing weekend programs, which had phone-in, which had interviews and so on, one on Saturday and one on Sunday. And by then, too, I was doing the weekend breakfast show for Five Live, and they were almost hitting each other, and so I had to do one and then go around the corner and do the other, and that was good. Not wise, I don't think, but it didn't last all that long, but I liked doing it, and I continued to work for Five Live for quite a long time. That was the nearest thing to LBC, and in fact, they were taking some of the ideas from LBC to put into their schedule. And they had very good people. Jenny Abramski, of course, was running Five Live by then. And some other people who I knew. And I got to do some very good stuff there. And I went to Australia to do some programmes for them about the referendum they were having as to whether they should become a republic or not. And went to various other things, which I'd also done at LBC, gone to Brussels for a few programmes, and to Moscow, and that was all new and terrific and very hard work. So that just kept trundling on, and eventually things started to just be less, and it got to a point where Jim Moyer said enough, and then Bob Shannon, he said, I've been hoping I didn't have to tell you this, but we're making changes and we're not renewing your contract. And I said, I wondered how long it would take you to tell me, you know, because I thought it was going on a bit long. So that was that. And I was doing just an odd thing here and there. And then it got to the stage where on the day of Prince William's wedding to Kate Middleton, I had been asked by a friend who produced programmes if I would present one that day live, and it was for Australia only. It was to go out on ABC National, which is right across the country, and it would be called Not the Royal Wedding. And the idea was that we would give a kind of picture of London and the event, which goes on at the same time as the wedding was going on. So we got a lot of namey people and Australian people to give them a bit of warmth, you know, keep them satisfied. And it worked kind of well. And the ABC said that they were very happy with it. And that was my last radio programme. I've not done anything since. And every now and again, somebody comes and says, would you like to do a programme? I said, well, no, I've done. I finished that. And that was that. I'm pretty sure I haven't done anything since then. So here I am.
I'm Brian Hayes, and this has been my last show on Five Live. So any moment now, Mr. Hayes will leave the building.
I hope you don't mind, I hope you don't mind that I put down in words.
I used to listen to radio quite a lot when I wasn't on it. I'd got out of the habit, I think, and then I started to listen again, not to phone-ins and things, because that would just make me cross. And I listened to music stations. I've always liked popular music as opposed to pop music. But then I started to want something a bit more meat, and I listened to Radio 3 quite a lot. But I got to the stage now where I hardly listen to radio at all, and when I do, it tends to be kind of Radio 4 talk programs and some Radio 3. Radio doesn't draw me as much as it did, and I think that's probably just my age as much as anything else. Disc jockeys don't attract me to listen to their programs. They perform a little bit too much. They try to make themselves something that they are not. They think they've got to be a showman. They got to the stage where there was more of them than there was of the music. Kind of hysterical, shouting in the morning. And why are there now two people presenting programs everywhere at breakfast time? You know, we don't need two. It just makes it more complicated. Yes, I occasionally look back and think, do I regret doing anything? Going right back to 1955, I do regret, although I had no control over it, the way the Radio 2 breakfast worked out. You know, it's easy to understand, but there is a tinge of regret. What a shame. And somebody from the Today programme, who I'd known and had worked at LBC, he said, you know, the BBC's never known what to do with you. That rang a bell, and I thought, I think that's probably true, because I never got a slot that actually was me. And I thought, well, it's too late now anyway. I think I would like to be remembered, if anybody bothers to, and I can't see why they would. I'd like to be remembered, if they're going to bother, as somebody who actually brought something a little bit different to the British radio scene at that particular time. I thought I kept moving it. That's what I was intending to do, and that's what I wanted to do, and that's what I had as a driving force when I was a child. Each move I made was because I think I can do it. That was my policy, although my kind of 15-year-old self was not bright enough to have a policy. But I knew I wanted to do things and move on to do other things, etc. So I was always happy about that, and I would like to be remembered for somebody who did that, who kind of looked at something and thought that can be improved, and subsequently did so. And if I didn't do that, well, I'll have to go back and start again.